This is John Rivette doing an interview with Dale Brickner on the 13th of July, 1995. I think this will take more than one session, but I think an hour of this is more than enough for me today. Maybe briefly have you do just a short background about yourself, but since the next event I need some information for is on the history of school labor-industrial relations, we'll sort of do some of your early life short and get to here and then ask you questions about the labor program service history. Is that okay for today?
Anything is fine.
Okay. So for the record, if you would state when you were born, where you were born, your first jobs, and how you got interested in the labor movement, that would be helpful.
All right. I was born, actually, with my name reversed. My birth certificate says my name is George Dale Brickner, but that's an error, according to my family. But it's been Dale G. Brickner, which I managed to hornswoggle over the years. I was born August 4th, 1928, in Hopedale, Ohio, by accident. My family actually was living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and my mother went to visit her mother, who lived in Hopedale, Ohio, before I was supposed to have been born, but in fact she went into labor in Ohio, and therefore I was born in Ohio.
So
I'm an accidental Buckeye.
Oh, wow.
Is the easiest way to look at this.
You never worked for Ohio State or any place
no,
like that?
No, okay. Never took advantage of my Buckeye heritage. At the time, my father had started a small auto electric shop in Pittsburgh on Carson Street, which is on the south side of Pittsburgh. And prior to that, he'd been a union electrician, actually a lineman, for years and years and years and years and years.
IBEW? Got,
yep. Joined IBEW, I think, in 1922 or 1923. He was a socialist and an agnostic by profession.
By profession?
Yes, he professed both.
I see.
We did not have a crucifix in our house. We had Jean Debs hanging in our house. That's who we worshiped. Lots of pictures of Jean Debs. But my father had escaped World War I by working on the railroad. Railroad workers were exempt during World War I. But he made the mistake of getting blackballed on the railroad strike in the switchman strike in 1921 or 22.
Okay.
And then he decided he wanted to do something else, so he apprenticed as an electrician, and that took care of all of that. And then I think got caught up, I don't know, the family story may be somewhat apocryphal in the boom and bust mentality of the 20s, like everyone could be an entrepreneur, and he decided automobiles were here to stay, so he said, well, I know all the electrical stuff, I'm going to do this. Well, of course, he lost his shirt. And we moved to Buffalo, where I was really raised, when I was 3 years old, which must have been 1931. And my father got a job working for Curtiss Airplane.
Hmm.
And
was Curtiss Airplane a full-scale airplane maker? I mean,
yeah, they were making something called the Bluebird for the Navy. It was a little plane. Well, actually, they were doing the development work on a little plane that had, believe it or not, a hook on it. And you could fly up underneath a dirigible and land the plane, and it could be transported for numbers of miles on the bottom of a dirigible and then take off and fly away. But he was always very, my father essentially was a socialist, a labor union person. He and two other guys formed a union at Curtiss Airplane, and was given a charter by a directly affiliated charter with the AFL, and they went on strike, to make a long story short, in 1934 for recognition. The company essentially busted the strike. The AFL-CIO abandoned them, much to my father's chagrin, so he became a devout CIO person when the CIO came upon the scene. But essentially, he was blacklisted. We were on welfare for about 3 or 4 years during the recession, depression. I got my glasses on the picket line.
Your glasses?
Yes. My father took me out on the picket line when I was, 6 years old? 28 to 34, that makes sense. 5 or 6, since it was in the summer. And the National Guard raided the picket line that day, and I got knocked down, and a tear gas canister rolled in front of my face and gave me something called traumatic astigmatism. So that's why I wear glasses today.
Oh.
Is because I was in the hospital for about 2 weeks with bandages over my eyes.
Oh.
So I got my dose of trade unionism very early in life. he tried to get other jobs. I'll just give you one. He went to Sikorsky up in Connecticut, and they hired him because he had such a great record as a skilled tradesperson. He worked there exactly one day when his record at Curtis caught up with him, and they fired him. Mm. So all this stuff about the NLRB being able to protect you, my father was a great skeptic.
Uh-huh.
Of course, it hadn't really kicked in then. I mean, we're talking about 34 and 35, and really the law didn't start getting enforced till about 37 or 38. But basically, he couldn't get a job in Buffalo, and one of the things he did, which it might be interesting for labor history purposes, was that a cousin of his, who was like 10 years younger, died. His name was John Barnes, and he lived in Niagara Falls. And my father adopted his name and social security number and got all kinds of jobs under his name. He worked as on the WPA. He was an electrical foreman. He used to have kids who graduated as electrical engineers from the University of Buffalo working for him as electricians. He didn't appreciate that much. He said they know stuff on paper, but they couldn't run a goddamn wire down the wall, you know. So that wasn't his idea of having a good electrical crew. But one of the things, to just finish that part of the story, when he finally got to a place in his life where he had reestablished himself and it was pretty clear they weren't going to discriminate against him anymore, he went down to Social Security, just to show you what a swinging organization it was in those days, and says to him, here's what I did. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, let's see your records and that sort of thing. He showed them to him, and he showed him the death certificate for this nephew or whatever relative it had been. They said, fine. They just combined his Social Security record, and he went on his merry way. You know, his two-person personality disappeared, and everything he'd earned under this phony name went away. But the way he got restored was that in 38, roughly, he just packed up his bags and went down and got a job in the WPA, which was 100% union. He joined the Chattanooga local of the IBEW because he'd previously had a card in the IBEW. And
Chattanooga?
In Chattanooga, yeah. And then after he'd worked there for about 3 years, including building the plant for the Manhattan Project, he thought it was just a munitions factory until they dropped the atomic bomb, and then he found out that he'd wired this thing that built the atomic bomb, and being a pacifist, he was not very happy about this. But, so then he just took his card and moved it back to Buffalo. So he was working when he died in 1954. He was still working as an electrician at Cornell Avionics building they were building out near the airport. So he'd been an IBEW member for long, long periods of time. So that takes care of the question, why did I have an interest in the trade union movement?
Uh-huh. Right.
That plus the fact that Buffalo at that time had an interesting thing. The minister of our church, Herman Hahn, was a pacifist, a socialist. He preached something called the social gospel. So all of the radicals in Buffalo used to come to that church, Catholics, Protestants, everyone in the world. And my mother was the president of the Ladies' Aid for 25 years. And my father was very active in all that kind of stuff. I formed the first YPSL chapter in Buffalo out of the Children of the Congregation. At Salem Evangelical and Reformed Church on Calumet Street in Buffalo, New York, in Riverside. So there were all kinds of people, like people that ran the YWCA and, you know, just an assortment of lefties, as you would say, John, were associated with this thing from all over. Many of them German socialists, old German socialists, or, you know, all kinds of Mullers and Mullers and Millers and Kunzes and Grautmans and all this sort of thing. So that sort of sustained the whole thing. Then that's where the intellectual elite of the church is what convinced me, who persuaded me. They were the ones who persuaded me to go to Antioch, because it was sort of a swinging college, which I did. And basically majored, I wanted to be a journalist, actually. So I made, there was no school of journalism in a tiny college, so I majored in economics and minored in English, which was the recommended approach to the thing. So my assortment of jobs while I was at Antioch started with working for something called the Labor Committee to Combat Intolerance, which was funded by B'nai B'rith, by the National Council of Churches, and by some Catholic group, the name of which I cannot remember. But the whole idea of this thing was to go around to unions and persuade them to be colorblind, sexblind, that kind of thing. So that's how I got into education. My first year in college, I worked for them. Then I decided I should get my hands dirty. So I said, well, I'm not going to... Oh, no, my first job actually was working in a department store. I take that back. My second job was working for the department store in Buffalo. And the reason I did that was I needed money. And if I took my co-op job in Buffalo, I could live home and save all my money. Mm-hmm. And then the Labor Committee to Combat Intolerance job was number two. Number three at Antioch was that I worked as a laborer in Carnegie, Illinois, in Gary, Indiana. Because I wanted to see the steel workers were my idea of a real union.
Right.
You know.
So did you do a labor job in the steel mill?
Actually, John, for the historical record, and this you may or may not want to use, I was a hooker.
Oh.
You know what a hooker is? He's the guy that loads the box cars that come through, the flat cars with the cranes up above you, and it's not what normally in this day and age called a hooker.
No. That's what it was.
That's what it is, too. I still think it is. I still think they call them hookers. Then my fourth job and my fifth job, I spent two work periods there, was as a police reporter on the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And then I got my job working for Hal Gibbons, being assistant editor of Midwest Labor World, after I'd had a couple hitches as a rookie newspaper reporter.
So when did you go to work for Gibbons?
Oh, it must have been 68. Yeah, oh yeah, 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 yeah. It was, I spent from
48,
I mean, from, let's see, January, February, March. So it would have been the spring work period, which is April, May, June, July, and August. I worked for Gibbons.
In St. Louis?
Yeah.
What do you call the paper?
Midwest Labor World. We had a circulation of 12,500. I could tell you a lot of combat stories, which I'm sure you don't want to hear.
Go ahead and do that another time.
Yes, right. Like floating 14,000 papers down the Mississippi River to keep me from going to jail for perjury.
Ooh, what had you written?
Huh?
What did you
Nothing, write? Except we tried to organize the department stores, and we hit one when they were open at night. And then the other two said, well, we were planning to do the same thing with them, and it would disrupt their business at night, and they wanted to get an injunction. And I had written a story for the paper which said that similar, the key words were, similar demonstrations are planned at Sticks, Bear, and Fuller and Famous Bar. And the paper went to press, and just as it was going to press, I walked out of the print shop, and one of our attorneys rolled up, of course, in a Cadillac. This was a Teamster local, and says, you're wanted in court. And I said, I'll tell you what to say on the way. So he told me what to say. He said, their whole case is based on the theory that we plan to do this in other stores. And he said, all we have to do is deny it, and they won't get an injunction. And I said, wait a minute. I had the proofs in my back pocket. I said, read this. And he says, oh, shit. Well, just get up and do what I said in terms of testifying. We'll take care of this problem. So I went in and lied, perjured myself in court. So that night, we took all the papers that had been printed, cut all the slips off of them, floated them down the Mississippi River, and then rewrote the paper and printed it by morning. So.
Wow.
One of my better stories about St. Louis.
Story.
Yes.
How big was the Teamsters in St. Louis?
About then? That size, about 12,500. Uh-huh. I mean, they had everything. Taxi drivers. Hal Gibbons had organized everything in the goddamn world. Buster Brown shoes. We had shoe factories. We had nursing homes. That's when he had, LHI, I'm right, Labor Health Institute, was upstairs from us, which was their version of the kind of ILG thing. We taxed employers for providing what amounted to what we now would call an HMO, where anyone could come in with anything. They treated them in the same building we were operating in. And I came to them before the Teamsters actually gave Gibbons a charter, but when it was a done deal. So it was right on the cusp of him getting into Local 6, taking over Local 688, because the old guard, some of the old Teamster business agents arrived on the scene like a week after I turned up. One of my other semi-humorous stories was that we had what we called Gibbons Cadillacs in the parking lot, and the Gibbons Cadillac was a Ford that was stripped down. And Hal Gibbons was the kind of person who would sit in a staff meeting and say, St. Louis has a very mild climate, and I'm not sure that we really need heaters in these cars because the winters aren't this bad. Well, that's when heaters were an option in cars.
Okay.
That's how much of a skinflint he was.
It gets cold there sometimes in winter.
Tell us about it. We finally persuaded Hal that maybe a heater would be nice, but...
Has anybody written a definitive book on him yet?
Not that I know of.
I can't think of
one.
No,
and he was a real character.
He
had a bizarre sex life, among other things. He had he had a very attractive, influential, rich woman who had a major league thing for him. And he used to go to lunch, and this great big Lincoln would pull up in front of the place, her chauffeur-driven car, and they would whisk off for the afternoon. It was funny. But getting back to the Teamsters, we had all of these rowdy CIO guys who had been really rough and tumble. I mean, you know, we're talking in the days when negotiating a contract was still a head-banging contest. They were organizing all over the place. Dick Kavner was the head of our organizational department. And as they said, anything that moves, we'll take them. Then we had these really dead-ass people. We had a guy on the payroll. His name was...
You had these CIOs organizing for the Teamsters.
Well, basically, the local was in existence because Gibbons had had a fight with RWDSU, which was his original union. And it was a question of who was calling who a socialist and who was calling who a communist, you know. And Gibbons was what I would call a ideological socialist, and he thought some of the lefties that were running the International were too far out in left field for him.
Right.
So he just disaffiliated. And then he was independent for, I think, about a year and a half or 2 years, and then he cut this deal to absorb 688.
Oh, okay.
But 688 basically was just sort of an amalgamated local. It had a little of this and a little of that, but it didn't bring a lot of membership into his union, quote-unquote. Not a lot. I mean, he had most everything organized already. They'd just been fighting each other. One way to stop fighting each other was to merge them, you know.
Okay.
Because we had taxis, we had any place you walk, you could say, I work for Local 688, and someone would say, oh, you want a free ride? You know?
Because of that, was there a very small CIO in St. Louis?
I don't know. I was so young and not really attuned to... the bigger implications of Local 688 that I don't have an honest answer. I never really, but he was clearly the most aggressive, best known labor leader in the city. I mean, all you had to do was say Hal Gibbons and everyone would say, oh yeah, you know.
So you were working for him 2 summers while a student.
One summer, yeah. And then when I got through with that job in the end of July, we had August off. That was our vacation. We were supposed to go back to school in September and October, which I did. And then is when Lou Corey, who was my mentor at at Antioch. I'll tell you the Luke Corey story someday, but he wrote Meat and Man and some of the labor books about the meat industry and that kind of stuff.
It's right there somewhere.
Right.
I've seen it.
I think it's behind you.
Oh, okay. I've seen it in here before.
Right. The one who tells me I have bad taste in other things, but not my wife. Mm. Nice of you, Lou. But he knew everyone in the labor movement because he went way, way, way back. And he had been the first president of the Socialist Workers Party or something like that, and then changed his name, Lou Fringa. He was in Reds.
Uh-huh.
And then he was. Then he taught at Antioch, and he was one of the two members of the economics department. The other one had his PhD from Harvard, which was kind of contrast with Lou Corey. But Lou got me a job as an organizer with the American Newspaper Guild because I had worked in there, and he said, you should do some organizing to get a little more background on the labor movement. And I said, fine. But I went to the famous Cleveland Convention of the CIO in 1949, and that's where they threw out IUE and the three other unions, FE, UE, and IUE was created, and FE was told to merge with the UAW, etc. And
you went there as a reporter for somebody?
No, I went there to meet my new boss, Sam Eubanks, who was the executive director of the what was then called the American Newspaper Guild, was just called the Newspaper Guild now, or the Guild. And Uncle Phil announced to all the international unions that in order to get the IUE up and running, he wanted them to make donations. Well, the Newspaper Guild is a tiny little union, didn't have any money. So Sam Eubanks says to me, instead of organizing in Ohio, how would you like to go to Washington and we'll donate you to help them get their international papers started? Well, that's how I ended up in Washington. I don't think I collected a paycheck from IUE. Part of the story is that it got to be December and I was supposed to go back to school in January, and my boss on the IUE CIO News, Art Reardon, said, could we work out something so you could stay with us another 3 months and then go back the spring semester and just switch, rotate, because we really need you now, we're just getting started. And I walked into the IUE headquarters when there were three moving men and four desks being moved into the 14th floor of an office building in Washington, and that was the extent of the staff. I was sort of standing there looking for who was going to pay me. But, so I called up the school and they said, sure, you can just finish the classes you started in October. You can do it April, May, and June rather than doing it January, February, and March. Well, then guess what happened? They said, gee, we could really use you to stay on. So I ended up dropping out of school for a year, which was fine because I made a ton of money. I was almost always on the road. I was the only single PR newspaper person that didn't have a family or anything else. So if they wanted someone in Hoboken or Dayton or Frickner, you don't have a family, you go do it. So I was living on an expense account, simply putting my paycheck in the bank. Now, my paycheck, John, I was considered a second-year reporter under the Guild contract in Washington, the historical record should show this, was $52.80 a week, which was big money in those days.
$52.80 a week.
That's right. I tell you, I was always bucking to become a third-year reporter after I'd cleared about 8 months, but I think I actually made it. But then, that would
so
take
you saw
us
a lot of labor stuff that year.
Oh yeah,
Well, you really saw a lot of events.
Yes, I did indeed. I got barred from a national conference on worker health and safety because John L. Lewis was mad at me. I walked in to do the conference as the IUE representative on health and safety, and John L. Lewis had looked at the delegate list and recognized my name. Just to tell you how sharp this guy was, as the person who had a byline on a story badmouthing his brother Denny Lewis for trying to raid old UE locals and cutting us out. And John L. says, if this guy comes, the mine workers are not coming to the conference. Well, guess who left? I did. Because Truman was not going to have a conference without the mine workers there. But that's a different story. But yeah, that was a really wild and woolly period in the history of the labor movement, because it was before merger. It's when the AFL-CIO was trying to clean out all of its crooks, and the CIO was trying to clear out all of its commies. It was beginning of the McCarthy era.
Well, Lewis, some of those years, wasn't AFL. He was really a third.
Yeah, oh yeah, he was out. I mean, he wasn't in any of
District 50.
Yeah.
He was organizing everyone.
Well, that was, yeah, Denny ran District 50.
Yeah.
Right.
So you had three competitors.
Oh, we had the IAM were raiding our locals, and a lot of AFL unions were raiding it, sure. I mean, we had them all over our case. IBEW, IAM, depending on what the plant was. Yeah, I fought a lot of AFL unions. I wouldn't tell this to anyone here. Wrote a lot of nasty things.
Oh, sure. Well, everybody's writing nasty about everybody else.
Yeah, right.
I wonder sometimes if labor would be better off if there were more competitors. Maybe
deregulate them, John, so we get more competition. That's an idea.
Sometimes there are problems when it's all the same.
That's for sure. So now you want to leap to labor education?
There are two choices. The easiest would be to just continue with this vein, which is the easy way to go, sort of chronological, and do another interview in a week or something.
I don't know.
It's your choice.
Whatever you want to do. Well, it sort of gets into labor education.
It does. So this is just fine with me. We were talking about you're being barred from a John L. Lewis Health and Safety Conference. You're running around for a year with the American...
Right.
On loan from American Newspaper Guild to IUE. Mm-hmm. Still not finishing up an Antioch degree.
Right.
So where's... Okay.
So then I left IUE in August of 1950, got married. Then I went back to Antioch, and I just took one full year of school with no work study. I put in all I needed for working. The work part of work study was over.
You were an exemplary Antioch work study student.
In the meantime, of course, Harry, when I was there, had gotten into his little police action in Korea. That was, May or June of 1950. So all of us who had fully expected to be drafted the minute we got out of school, except that they gave exams in November of that year, and if you got over what the number was, you could apply for a one-year exemption to go to graduate school. So I opted, as between a master's degree and a PFC, I opted for. And I had, where could I have gone to graduate school? UCLA, Illinois, or Wisconsin, I think.
How did you come down to those three?
That's the ones I applied to. That would give me an assistantship. I may have applied to more, I'm not quite sure. Carol wanted to go see California, so we went to UCLA. One of the reasons they wanted me was that because of my work experience, they had been hired by the theatrical unions broadly to come up with some kind of a plan to merge all of them in the face of the technological challenge from something called TV.
Uh-huh.
So you had AFTRA, you know, all the little splinter groups, Theatrical Guild, and all these who felt that it was going to be difficult negotiating with what was now going to be a burgeoning new technology. Mm-hmm. So I did some interesting things like AGVA, American Guild of Variety Artists, president was Jimmy Durante. I had lunch with him at the Red Fox and all kinds of amusing stories from that era.
Was he a good trade unionist?
Oh, he must have been. He was president of the union. I don't know if that, considering the fact that Ronnie Reagan was, I'm not sure that.
Now, was Reagan president of the union the year you were involved in?
I don't think so. I mean, it doesn't ring a bell with
probably
me.
Before.
Yeah. It doesn't ring a bell. But in any case, I was a grad assistant in the Institute, that is Labor Relations Institute, and I majored in economics because they don't have a degree in labor relations, still don't. And And then I was about to be drafted the following spring, which would have been, what, 51? But as it happened, Carol was, by that point, pregnant. So I went down to take my physical and asked them sort of casually, does it make any difference if you're a father? And they said, oh, yeah. So I brought in a slip. Never did go to Korea. Yeah. Because, fortuitously, Carol's one pregnancy occurred right when it should have. The one kid that she kept among her spontaneous abortions happened to be perfectly timed.
So you could get out if you were going to school, or if your spouse
Well, no,
was pregnant.
Your academic exemption only lasted 1 year.
Okay.
So I was called for my physical to be drafted in the summer of 51. But by that time, Carol was pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
That's not right. Stop. I got out of Antioch in 51, so I went 51-52. And Debbie was born in 50. Yeah, so it was 53. I take back 1 year. I was allowed to get my master's degree. And then we came back east, and I went to Cornell, basically, and then it was from Cornell, I went directly to IU.
You got a degree at UCLA?
Yes.
A master's.
Econ. Master's in econ. Right.
Then you went to Cornell and did what?
I went in their PhD program. I'd already passed my qualifying exams at UCLA. And because of some illness in my family and stuff, we decided to move back east, basically. So I was at Cornell from 53, which is when Deborah was born, to 57 when I went to IU for my first job.
Mm.
I didn't get my degree at Cornell because the chairman of my committee was an alcoholic. So I'd passed all my exams. I'd written my dissertation, which is still sitting in my desk at home, all 687 pages of it. But he conked out, and I couldn't get anyone else to form a committee to read my dissertation because no one knew anything about the application of antitrust laws to unions, which is what I wrote my dissertation on, because I'd minored in law at Cornell. I'd taken a lot of courses in the law mm-hmm. school. And they diddled around, and Fred Kahn, you know, Alfred Kahn, who worked for
the architect?
No.
Oh, The Economist.
The Economist, okay. Alfred Kahn, who was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors for Carter. He was my number two man on the committee, and he knew everything there was about antitrust laws, but he knew nothing about labor.
Okay.
So I got to Indiana, and they kept saying, well, we'll have a labor economist pretty soon. Well, it turns out the labor economist they eventually got was George Hildebrand, who was my great mentor at UCLA. But they said, oh, well, you're going to have to come back and now because of whatever timeline they had and spend another year in residence and we'll give you an assistantship. Well, an assistantship was like $1,400 and fundamentally I said, fuck you, I have a wife and a kid to support. You know, I'll just do without the degree because by that time I was doing well at IU, so I just said the hell with it. And they wouldn't relent on the residency thing. They said, you know, you've been gone more than, at that point it was 10 years since I'd first registered. And I wouldn't relent on, you're full of shit, I'm not going to come back and take my exam and then have to sit around there for a year working for slave labor wages. So we reached impasse on that. Although if you'd like to read the definitive treatise on the application of the antitrust laws to unions, I'll give you my dissertation someday. All 600 pages of it.
Maybe get an editor to get it published.
I don't think anyone would be interested anymore. Well, but,
So when you went to IU, it was to work as a labor educator?
No.
Okay, isn't it?
It's complicated. At IU, unlike Michigan State, where you have no School of Labor and Industrial Relations, mm-hmm. everyone that's in the labor school has to have an academic appointment in some uh-huh. department. So my academic appointment was in economics.
Okay.
And there was sort of this, well, if we need them, we'll use them, and if they don't, kind uh-huh. of thing. And actually, the first 3 years I was at IU, I did relatively little labor education, mostly in the summer when I didn't have any employment in the economics department. But in the fall semester and the spring semester, I would teach like basic econ, economics of labor economics, or in the summer, sometimes I teach collective bargaining. Fred Whitney and I alternated.
Okay.
One year I'd teach collective bargaining, and
Whitney taught
labor law, and then we'd switch. He'd teach collective bargaining and I'd teach labor law, so we alternated years on that. But I did that all the time when I was at IU, because the economics department still had a handle on me. I had to get promoted through them.
Mm-hmm.
So I was teaching academic classes all the time I was at IU. It was just a question of how much. For example, I taught a graduate seminar on wage theory every year. Now, no, I had three people in it. It wasn't, or two or three, it wasn't a big deal. You know, I'd have them come over to my office, like the three of us would sit around the table. And,
yeah.
That was my seminar on wage theory.
That was a nice one.
Yeah.
It's a good class.
But it got something out of the way for him.
Did you get to do
but
anything?
But what happened was that IU has this enormous load of summer schools, which you're well aware of. So I'd work my ass off all summer. So that's how I paid my dues to what was then Labor Education and Research Center, LERC. So I got most of my licks in labor education in the summer, and in the fall and winter I did mostly the other. Now, in 63, Emory Bacon from the steelworkers, who was an education director for the steelworkers, came bombing onto campus and said, here's an idea. And the steelworkers the year before, I think, I wouldn't swear to the date, but it was like their 61, 62 contract, had negotiated the famous sabbatical leave contract. So Emory was hell-bent on persuading people who were going to take these sabbaticals to come to a program at a university and expand their education. So he sold this idea to the Ford Foundation and to IU, to Herman Wells, who was sort of the John Hanna of IU. And Jim Robb, who was a regional director of the steelworkers. And basically, what happened was the economics department backed off. By this time, they had another labor economist and said, okay, we'll let Dale do this Ford Foundation thing, because they thought it was prestigious. So that's when the sort of 75-25 shift moved the other way. And I, for 3 years, I ran the resident labor education program, which was what this thing ended up being called, a sort of partnership between the steelworkers, the Ford Foundation, and Indiana University, where we literally went out and gave anyone who applied college entrance exams. We did individual interviewing. We brought 20 people to campus every fall and kept them there for the whole semester. We had our own resident faculty that we chose very carefully, like some guy in the English department who was liberal and pro-labor and that sort of thing. Set up a curriculum for them. We had people in political science. We sort of had a social science curriculum that was just aimed at these guys. I taught the economics class and that kind of
and
stuff.
And they were on their sabbatical from the
steel
worker plant.
Right.
So they'd all be similar ages and points in their
career. To some extent. Now, what happened was, of course, that once this thing got underway, the politicians in the union started saying, aha, isn't this a great place to do basic staff training? So that, you know, if we're spending all this money giving these guys this high-tech education, why don't we try to get people we'd like to appoint to the staff? So there was always a certain amount of friction. The original agreement was that we would choose people based strictly on their qualifications, like, have you already had a couple years of college? You know, how did you do on your IQ exam? That kind of thing. And as the program wore on, we got the Wisconsin district to participate in it, and we got District 25, which was the old one. 25, am I right? that was just Cincinnati. It was that corner of Ohio. It's since been merged with the Indiana district. It was eliminated in all the consolidations they did 10 or 15 years ago.
You didn't have the Northern Ohio Michigan district.
We came up and tried to talk to Charlie, and he was opposed to any kind of resident training for anyone. Oh. Young Love. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I remember flying to Detroit, and Harry Doherty and I tried to persuade Michigan to get in involved in the thing, and he said, no. And of course, this was the philosophy of the steelworkers, still is, as far as I know. We think it's a lot cheaper and more efficient to have people come and teach our people where they're at. We don't want to send anyone to, you know, goof off for 12 weeks on a university campus. So.
Who was the director of LIRC those first years you were working?
Whit Murphy.
Oh, it was always Whit.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was there when I came, and he was there when I left.
Where did he come from? Union background or
none
whatever?
Whatsoever. He didn't have a clue about what labor education was all about. As Carol used to say, he was good mainly just for making good remarks at opening banquets and things like that.
That you guys would write for him or something? Or he just said sort of positive, nice things in general that weren't really union
stuff? He sort of did political kinds of things and nothing else. Basically, by 65, I was assistant director, and I ran the operation from an administrative point of view because he also was not a very good administrator. And Whit just sort of bopped around and talked to labor leaders and did all kinds of things, but he never taught. Whit Murphy never taught a class. To my best knowledge and belief, Whit never taught a single class. He never did while I was there, and I was there from 57 to 73. Sometimes I wonder what, in fact, he did.
He did do.
Yes, because...
Was he teaching in the regular program somebody?
No,
some other
he
department?
Didn't like to do that either, because as I mentioned the fact that I was teaching wage theory, and George Wilson, who was chairman of the economics department, didn't think Whit knew all that much about economics, and of course wage theory is the most esoteric thing you can possibly teach. And he asked Whit to teach it, and he said, you know, if you want Dale to help you out, that's fine with me. And it ended up with me teaching it, so that's sort of how things were. And when I ran the resident program, it became clear to Whit that maybe I should be his backup on administration. It was one of those leaky boat kind of things, like he would make some decision about clerical employees or something like that, and then 2 days later he'd call me in and he'd say, I think we should reorganize the place, and why don't we have all the clericals report to you?
You were assistant director?
Yeah.
What?
The only clerical that didn't report to me was his personal secretary. So they were sort of off there doing all kinds of little things that I never really understood, but they didn't contribute much to the organization. And
who were your main colleagues, the other staff people on the program?
H. Haynes Turner,
oh.
Who was, of course, our professional peacenik. Haynes, you know, came from this Quaker background. And do you know Haynes' story?
Well, when you hired me in, first project...
That's right.
You first put me to work before while I was still on Corn Blue State,
because
you guys traded me and you each had me working each other's
right.
stuff. But after officially coming here, the first project you put me on was the Marshall Fund project to send
right.
labor leaders
labor
to
exchange
Europe. Europe.
Right.
And Haynes Turner was involved, and we flew to Chicago
well,
several times.
Haynes Turner is one of the three sons of the Turner Construction Company, which is a multi-million dollar thing, but they're all Quakers. And Haynes is one of the outcast sons. He's probably worth millions of dollars, and he was always running around in combat boots and acting like he didn't have a damn cent, except his wife drove Mercedes cars and things like that. But Haynes always professed to be indigent. His younger brother runs the corporation, but Haynes sort of got cut out by the old man, and the money that the old man left, he left to Haynes' wife, and she doles it out to him because the old man felt that he would be profligate, you know, he'd be giving it to... You know, right in the middle of the Vietnam War, Haynes came in one day and told me, since I was administering the place, that he didn't want to teach in the winter quarter, and this was like December 15th, and I said, why? And he said, because the American Friends Service Committee want to send me to Vietnam, and he just left. I mean, I said, you can't go, and he left, you know.
He was something.
His mission in life.
He was something.
Well, I had Haynes, I had Hig Roberts.
Oh, Hig was there. Then.
Right. Terry Connors, who was ultimately at Illinois. And we had a couple other people that sort of passed through briefly who made no mark in labor education, but those are the ones you'd know. What's his name? The guy that runs Tennessee was one of our grad students. What is his name?
I'm not sure I know who we're talking about.
Why can't I think of his name?
We can get a UCLA directory, but...
Yeah. But he was a PhD student at IU, and he learned labor education by following us around. But just as I left, the place was down to Hig, or no, Hig left for Alabama. No, what was the order? In a year and a half, three of us left. Hig left to become director at Alabama, which is a job Whit wanted me to apply for. Because he was sure he was going to lose me some way or other, and I said, I'm not going to Alabama. That was his alma mater.
Whit Murphy's?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Terry was supposed to become the director at Illinois, and then went over there on the assumption that he'd be there just a year, and then become director, and he decided he didn't want to become director, so he just dug in his heels. That's how they ended up getting Ron. And then I left. So this is like an 18-month period. And we had hired Dave Spencer and Keith Knaus to replace the aforementioned, the two that just left. And that's when I got my brilliant or not idea that we weren't getting our mileage out of labor education in Indiana by having people sitting in Bloomington, that we should go out to the regional campuses. And
so that happened before you left.
I sort of wrote the decentralization plan and then left, yes.
Uh-huh.
And that's how Keith ended up in South Bend, where he's been ever since, because he went there the year I left.
And who took over at that point? Who took, who put in effect, who followed you at IU?
I don't know who they hired. We already had Charlie Ellinger, was already at Indianapolis. And he was one of the people who was in the resident program. You know, he was my great success story in the resident program. He came in there as a steel worker who was working at Diamond Chain, and he had a couple years on his bachelor's degree and ended up with the credits we got him, getting a bachelor's and ultimately a master's degree, and then he ended up on the staff there. So
oh, that's a nice story.
Yeah. So he was basically one of the original steel workers the first year of 63 when we started the resident program. And Bill Baer, who went to Maine, was also a graduate of the resident program. Unfortunately, he dropped dead on the job at the University of Maine. And they had got about three or four staff reps out of it, all kinds of things. But that's neither here nor there. Getting back to the chronology of the thing. 73, I came here. Right.
You know, let's just save here, I guess. Because it's gonna get too many directions to go. So if we could just reschedule, that would be simple. Before here, can you just tell me a little bit about your involvement with ULEA and 189, and just there were a few things that happened before you came here in National Labor Ed. There were a couple stories I think you were involved with.
Well, you know, ULEA, as they used to call it, was an old boys club. And, you know, I can remember Whit sitting on the phone, and he'd be talking to High, Whit, I'm lost at who was the guy who was at Rutgers for 100 years. I can't think.
That's okay.
I want to say Bert, but it isn't Bert. Levine. Herb Levine.
Okay.
And, you know, they'd sit on the phone and have a conference call and decide who was going to be president that year.
Uh-huh.
And Jack McKenzie, you know, I mean, it was really just an old boys club.
Right.
And there were no staff inputs into this at all. The only time the staff got involved in a ULEA meeting was if Whit couldn't go to Washington, he said, Dale, will you go represent me? So it was like zip, it was just the director's club.
So you didn't really get to do much or have much
nothing.
To do
I
with
knew
other
nothing.
Labor educators?
You know, we always assumed it was the directors getting together.
Uh-huh.
University Labor Education Association was directors periodically got together and drank and ate and schmoozed in Washington
uh-huh.
for a couple of days and came home and we didn't know shit about it. They didn't publish anything, they didn't do anything. And that's the way it was when I came here, more or less.
And that's in some ways what workers at 189 then was letting
yeah,
young
well,
folks talk
I was
to each
part
other.
Of the movement that says, you know, is this a group that's going to represent labor educators or is this a group
mm-hmm.
that's going to represent just the directors? I sort of asked that question at various
mm-hmm.
points in time, getting no clear-cut answers. But that's when it sort of started opening up, and they actually had some meetings.
Uh-huh.
And it was pretty tumultuous because you had Herb was in there, and George Boyle had been president for, two terms or three terms. They sort of took it forever. But then they finally came up with a constitution in the late 60s, I think, early 70s, that said you had to go through the chairs, like you had to be on the executive board for a while, and
mm-hmm.
then you became president-elect, and then you had to serve as president-elect for at least a year, and then you automatically became president.
A constitutional voice club.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
But a little
and then you had to serve for another year as an advisor on the executive board
uh-huh.
to the incoming new president, that kind of thing. And that's how I got into it. I mean, I had about 7 years on UCLEA before I became president in 75 or five. I guess it was a five-year hitch. But then the wheels were coming off the cart at that point. You were getting opposition candidates, you were getting people nominated from the floor, and you know, the whole question of what the hell kind of an organization is this? Does it represent
mm-hmm.
labor educators, or does it represent others? I was a member of 189 forever. I think when I first went there, because I've always carried some kind of a union card, I'm still a member of AFT,
mm-hmm.
state AFT.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they kicked them out, my theory was, well, is it really a union anymore? I want to belong to a union. And my answer was no. So I just did stop participating. But I wrote a couple articles for 189, whatever they called their publication in those days. I wrote one.
Labor Viewpoints.
Viewpoints, right. On the resident program. And then I did one on
mm-hmm.
resident programs generally and things
mm-hmm.
like that. Yeah.
I've got those.
I never had anything against 189. It was
mm-hmm.
just that once it left, it ceased to be a union
right.
union.
Mm-hmm.
Then I thought, well, maybe we should get our act together and all talk about labor education in one place, which I guess was my real position on the whole thing.
The only difference was I decided to pay dues to both.
That's right.
So I've been paying dues to MFT and 189.
Yeah.
Since that point. So you just save more money in your pocket.
That's right. That's right.
But,
got more in my pension fund, yeah.
More? No, I have fully funded there. You had more in home improvements. But just in other stuff of that sort. Well, I guess we could do the UCLEA later as part of the director's job here. This is just a fine place to stop
okay.
by me.
All right. Stop.